I'm certainly not dissatisfied by the verdict. I think this was a very difficult case, a very challenging case, and a case that really moved our understanding of what sexual assault is, where it can occur, shattered myths that I think have been part of the criminal justice system for a long time. So I believe a B felony conviction with a maximum of up to 25 years, it is not the top counts in the indictment, but by no means am I disappointed with the jury's unanimous statement that Harvey Weinstein is guilty of sexual assault and rape.
Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance, after Harvey Weinstein was found guilty on 2 out of the 5 charges against him, he was acquitted of the more serious charges, predatory sexual assault, which carried a life sentence. It's been more than 2 years since the allegations against Weinstein first came out and ignited the Me Too movement. Since then, allegations of sexual assault and harassment have poured out, and the Me Too movement has brought down at least 200 powerful men. Joining me now to talk about what this verdict means for that movement is Saraya Shamali, author of the book Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you. And joining me also is James Quealy. He's been covering the trial for the LA Times. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. You were there today in the courtroom. What was Weinstein's reaction?
So it was hard to see because a dozen court officers showed up, but he you could not see him during the actual reading of the verdict, but after, as he was about to be led out of the room in handcuffs after the judge ordered him held on remand, it almost seemed as if he was struggling, almost hesitant to go with them as they handcuffed him. And as we've seen throughout the trial, he's suffering from a lot of physical ills right now, and he almost wasn't forcibly dragged but seemed to basically be relying on the court officers to walk out of the room. He just looked very weak, almost a little humbled.
Yeah, because he has been free on bond since the trial began, so this is the first time he has been escorted into a jail cell.
Yes, he may have been briefly in a cell on his immediate arrest, but yeah, ever since the charges in 2018, he's been out on bail under an ankle monitor.
And when will he be sentenced?
Sentencing is now currently scheduled for March 11th.
March 11th. He also faces charges here in Los Angeles. Any news on those charges?
Not much has changed there. I talked to a representative for the Manhattan DA's office today. They said they don't believe LA will be able to do anything until after the sentencing at the earliest. He has not been arraigned, has not appeared in Los Angeles. As you might remember, Jackie Lacey did not file charges against him in LA until the day before jury selection started in New York. So we don't have any sort of schedule there. But he does face multiple counts of sexual assault in LA from two different allegations from 2013.
Okay. Saraya, what is your reaction to the verdict today?
My reaction, honestly, is of relief. Virtually every woman I know, whether it's a woman in media or a woman who isn't remotely involved in media, really doubted that there would be a conviction. And I think that's because we generally have a pretty clear understanding of the failures of the criminal justice system to address sexual violence. And we're trying to set expectations. So I'm sort of relieved. I'm happy to see that they convicted on these two counts. I'm unhappy that the predatory sexual assault count was not the point made in this particular trial.
And that was those were the charges that involved the actress Annabella Sciorra, and the statute of limitations had passed on her particular allegations. Can you remind us what she said happened to her?
Well, if I recall, very early in the process, people were saying, well, what he did, what they're describing, isn't really rape. It's not, it doesn't fit our definition. And she said, is that what you want? Because if that's what you want, I'm going to tell you what he did to me, and it will fit anybody's definition of rape. And she then went on in graphic and detailed terms to describe his forcibly raping her. Mm. And I think that's a very familiar dynamic. You know, people have some pretty hard and fast stereotypes about what constitutes rape, and that idea of a violent, forcible rape is kind of the ultimate perfect victim rape. And she said, okay, these other women have come forward. I'm watching them come forward. I'm going to tell you what happened to me, and there can be no ambiguity about this.
James, we haven't heard from the jurors themselves yet, and we may never hear from them, but is it fair to assume that they didn't believe her account or did not find it credible or enough on the panel didn't find it credible to convict on those charges?
Well, right. By definition, Annabella's allegations, as you said, could not be tried on their own. They could only be tried as part of the predatory sexual assault statute. So, yeah, considering that they convicted on one accusation involving Mimi Halley and one accusation involving Jessica Mann, it stands to reason they didn't believe that. I don't know if they didn't believe Ms. Sciarra or find her credible necessarily. Obviously, like you said, we can't get in their heads, but they certainly didn't believe her story beyond the reasonable doubt, and they didn't convict on that. Yeah, there were attempts to get the jurors to talk today. They all were ushered out of the court building pretty quickly and past the media. They did not seem terribly conversational today.
Hmm. So 23 women who have accused Weinstein of sexual misconduct put out a statement after the verdict today. They call themselves the Silence Breakers. And they said in part, while it's disappointing that today's outcome does not deliver the true full justice so many women deserve, Harvey Weinstein will now forever be known as a convicted serial predator. This has been a flawed process from the beginning, but has further exposed the difficulties women face in coming forward to tell the truth about powerful abusers. Soraya, what does this do moving forward for women who might want to come forward and press charges?
You know, I think that it's really complicated. I don't think that the course of this case or Harvey Weinstein's trial has done a whole lot to convince women that coming forward is easier, simpler, that they'll have more credibility. I mean, these were 23 women, some of whom are very famous, very credible. They have a lot of cultural capital. And yet still we see the way the judicial process decontextualizes the crime, isolates victims. Over 100 women have come forward with stories. And yet we're supposed to, in theory, because of the way the process works, ignore what they're saying. And so I think any woman looking at this and coming forward would get very mixed messages.
Uh-huh. And what do you make of the argument put forth by Weinstein's lawyer, Donna Rotuno, she's a critic of the Me Too movement in some parts, and she's not saying that all the women don't have credible claims, but the women in this particular case, she argued, of course, didn't. But in a broader sense, she's arguing that women have responsibilities here, too, that they many of them shouldn't have gone up to his hotel room in the first place. What do you say about that, argument that the women bear some responsibility here?
Yeah, I mean, I think nobody would argue that women bear some responsibility, but the argument that she's making, which is a very typical conservative one, it's very sort of rooted in just world theories. It is an argument that completely erases the reality of power, of economic disparities, of the influence that a man like this wields in his industry, of the very precarious position that young women are in, that all women are in, but particularly young women who might be ambitious. And so I think that when you hear rationalizations like hers, which also, by the way, included a lot of other things, like I would never find myself in this position, for example, which largely, again, implies that the women should have known better, that they shouldn't have been there, that they shouldn't have been dressed. That's all very victim blaming, right? And so it's not surprising to me. I think it's a very good example of the fact that there are women who hold these beliefs that are very conservative, that are, you know, they have high rape myth acceptance. And a lot of the things that she said is grounded in rape mythologies. And there are a lot of men who don't. A lot of men who are very progressive. They understand what power looks like and how it operates.
How much of the fact that Harvey Weinstein was the most powerful symbol for sexual assault, sexual abuse, sexual misconduct, basically igniting the Me Too movement, versus, you know, talk about the difference between that, he is a symbol, and also the actual reality of trying someone in a courtroom and the facts in the case. There's a big difference there, isn't there?
You mean considering the symbolic value of his being found guilty or of his being tried in the first place?
Tried in the first place.
Well, I mean, I do. I think that there was no doubt that given the pressure brought to bear by the Me Too movement, which I would say is, you know, sort of on the current tail end of a decades-long public consciousness raising movement of these issues, of the way women have to navigate predatory violence. I don't think it would have been possible for that many women. And again, we're talking about 100 women, one man, similarly to Bill Cosby, where you had tens of dozens of women and one man. I just don't think it would have been possible not to move forward with the jury.
Mm-hmm. But still, trial. It does show how difficult it is to win convictions, even though he was convicted on two charges. He was not convicted on three, and it was very difficult to find women to go forward in this case to begin with.
Right. And I think, again, that goes back to the real costs and penalties of speaking openly. I mean, we just had recently a case with Kobe Bryant where a Washington Post reporter simply shared an article about his sexual assault trial. And she was roundly criticized and then dismissed by her own newsroom for making making the Washington Post look bad. I mean, she wasn't even saying this was my case, this is what happened to me. She wasn't even reporting. She was just raising the fact that this was part of his legacy as well. And so coming forward with these stories still comes with serious risk.
Well, fair to say, though, Harvey Weinstein's life as he once knew it is pretty much over.
Yeah, it is. I think that's undeniable. And we still, as we just said, have the California charges.
Mm-hmm. James, will he appeal this conviction?
Yes, his defense has said they will definitely appeal, though they have not said on what grounds.
All right. James Quigley covers crime and policing for the LA Times. Soraya Shamali is the author of the book Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Well, as of today, the Trump administration can deny green cards to immigrants who have used or who are likely to use public services like food stamps or Medicaid. That's after the Supreme Court lifted the last lower court ruling that put the policy on hold. The decision was split along ideological lines, with the five conservative justices handing Trump the win. For now, at least, it's not a final decision on whether the actual policy is legal. That could still be years away. Here to talk about all this is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular League Legal. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So explain it for us, because there were two cases. This is just the latest of the two. The first, the court lifted a nationwide injunction on what is called the public charge policy, and that happened last month. So why did they revisit this case this time, and what did they say?
Yeah, actually, there were a bunch of different cases, but the first case that you were talking about was a judge that issued a so-called nationwide injunction. We've been using that phrase a lot more, that said, you can't implement Trump administration, this new public charge rule, but not just in this jurisdiction, but anywhere in the country. So about a month ago, the Supreme Court said, oh, yes, you can for now. We're pushing pause on your injunction. And then there was one state in which the injunction still stood, in which the Trump administration could not go forward on the change in the immigration law. And that is what the Supreme Court just stayed today. They basically stayed the stopping of that implementation. So now everywhere in the country, the new public charge rule can go forward.
And in brief, what does that mean?
Well, in brief, what it means is that it will be harder for low-income immigrants to be able to either stay here, get green cards, get work visas, obtain citizenship, that there's now a rubric that immigration officials can look at. And one of the things that will be a significant strike against you is if it looks like you might, for any period of time, be on public assistance. Now, what we know from lots of studies is that many immigrants, in fact, I think recently the number was close to 3/4 of immigrants, at some point, even just temporarily, while they're gaining citizenship, while they're waiting for a work visa, while they're waiting for their green card, do need to rely on a food stamp, Medicare, some sort of health care, something from the federal government to essentially stay alive, to subsist. That will now be a strike against you. So you will either have more people who will not ask for the assistance that they frankly need, or you will have fewer immigrants.
And by the way, these are immigrants who are largely working and paying taxes?
Yeah, these are, and I don't have the exact numbers, but largely immigrants who desperately want to work, who once they're working, absolutely do pay their taxes. But yes, who at some point will need some aid from the federal government. Again, the public charge rule would incentivize you to not ask for that assistance because you wouldn't want to strike against you. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to get your green card, your work visa. Now, the Trump administration has said that they're protecting taxpayer dollars, that what they're doing is something that is financially responsible, and that they are protecting Americans who need these programs, and they're protecting Americans who pay taxes into these programs.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a scathing dissent. What did she say?
I read the whole dissent. It was scathing. Justice Sotomayor is really angry, and you can just feel it come off the page. And what she says is basically, why are we issuing these stays of the injunctions? Why are we, the Supreme Court, coming in and doing something really unusual, which is pausing what the lower courts have done and not letting them work out the problem? We're not trial courts. We're not even the first court of appeals. We're the very last word. So one, why all of a sudden, conservative colleagues, all of these stays? And if you look at the numbers, I think it's something like the Trump administration has asked for three times the number of stays as the three other presidents, previous presidents combined. I mean, it's been an exponential increase in the number of stays that the Trump administration has asked for. And so she says, we have to look at ourselves, and I can blame some of my colleagues for this creation because we're usurping the power of the lower courts. And the whole point of the way our federal judiciary is structured is to let the trial court do the trial work. Then if there's an issue on appeal, let the Court of Appeals hear it. And then if there's some novel theory or constitutional issue or circuit split, that's when we come in.
And instead, the Trump administration is leapfrogging that process and going straight to the Supreme Court and saying, issue a ruling now.
Exactly. And so what happened in this case is the Trump administration had basically said, no, we want the public charge to the trial court. We want this public charge rule to go into effect. Trial court said no. They then appealed to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals said, I'm not pausing that decision. Let the process work its way out. Trump administration went, as it increasingly does, straight to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, okay, that's right. We'll pause what the lower court said. The rule can go into effect.
So again, this is not a ruling on whether or not the rule is okay. It's basically letting it happen while the arguments get worked out below.
Exactly. Now, of course, one thing you're supposed to weigh when you're deciding whether or not to issue first a preliminary injunction or second a stay is who's harmed. And one of the things that Justice Sotomayor talked about in her dissent is who would really be harmed by us just allowing the status quo to stay in effect and allowing what we so often have, which is allow the process to be worked out in the lower courts. Are we now taking up the role of the district court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court?
Okay, the court is going to hear arguments in another immigration case. What is this one about?
So this is an interesting case dealing with basically how broadly we're going to read the federal immigration law with respect to this one clause that says that you can't try and encourage people to either come to the country illegally or stay in the country illegally. And it's not a very often used statute. It came up because there was a woman who was essentially a lawyer, but who never passed the bar. So she went to law school, didn't pass the bar, was telling undocumented workers, I can file a bunch of forms for you, and then you might have a path to citizenship. She knew full well that they would not have that path, but she was just taking their money. She was therefore inducing them to stay, to illegally stay in the country. And she was prosecuted, one, for mail fraud, and two, under the statute that we're talking about. What happened after her conviction is that the Ninth Circuit Court said, actually, we want to look not just at her conviction, but the language of the statute. And the statute itself might actually violate the First Amendment because it's so broad. Are we going to penalize? One example is the grandmother who says to the grandson, no, I really want you to stay in the country. Or just a lawyer who in passing says, I really hope you'll stay in the country. I hope you'll try and fight this deportation. Are we criminalizing those types of general words? And that is the issue before the Supreme Court. how broadly or narrowly we're going to read that statute.
Could it also apply to, let's say, cities like Los Angeles, which say we're a sanctuary city?
Yeah. One of the questions that I'm pretty confident will not be resolved is, what does this mean for sanctuary states and sanctuary cities, where we say we're not going to cooperate with federal law enforcement and we're not going to help you do your job? I don't think the court's going to get to that issue, but it is an interesting issue of statutory interpretation and this federal immigration statute.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday Legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, remembering Kobe Bryant, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A moving scene at Staples Center today.
I'm here because I love Kobe. And this was one of his favorite songs. So I want to start that over, but I want us to do it all together. And I want you to sing it so loud they hear your love. Are y'all ready? Love you.
Your love is bright as ever.
Even in the shadows.
Beyoncé opened this morning's memorial for Kobe and Gianna Bryant and the seven other victims of last month's helicopter crash. Jimmy Kimmel held back tears as he read their names.
I want to thank everyone for being here, and thank you for gathering to celebrate the lives of Alyssa Altobelli, her parents, John and Carrie Altobelli, Peyton Chester, her mother, Sarah Chester, Christina Mauser, Ara Zabayan, Gigi Bryant, and her father, Kobe Bryant. This is a sad day, but it is also a celebration of life.
The date chosen for the celebration was symbolic, 2-24-20. 2 for Kobe's daughter, Gigi's jersey number, 24 for Kobe, and 20, the number of years he played with the Lakers, and also how long Vanessa and Kobe Bryant were together. Vanessa remembered her daughter, Gigi.
She was daddy's girl, but I know she loved her mama. And she would always tell me and show me how much she loved me. She was one of my very best friends.
Vanessa described the bond Kobe and Gianna shared, especially on the basketball court. She remembered how Kobe described himself as a father to four girls, with a hashtag that trended on social media in the days after his death.
Kobe was the MVP of girl dads, or MVD. He never left the toilet seat up. He always told the girls how beautiful and smart they are. He taught them how to be brave and how to keep pushing forward when things get tough.
Vanessa closed by saying, God knew Kobe and Gianna couldn't be on this earth without each other.
Babe, you take care of our Gigi. And I got Nani, Bibi, and Coco. We're still the best team. We love and miss you, Boo Boo and Gigi. May you both rest in peace and have fun in heaven until we meet again one day. We love you both and miss you forever and always. Mommy.
And then others spoke. Family friend and WNBA legend Diana Taurasi spoke, talking about how Gigi was the future of women's basketball.
A future where a young woman aspires to play in the WNBA, the same way I wanted to be a Laker. Gigi already had goals to play for UConn. That in itself showed her fearless mentality. She represents a time where a young girl doesn't need permission to play. Her skill would command respect.
Tears streamed down the face of basketball legend Michael Jordan as he spoke about Kobe, whom he called his little brother. And former teammate Shaquille O'Neal clarified his relationship with Kobe.
Kobe and I pushed one another to play some of the greatest basketball of all time, and I am proud that no other team has accomplished what the three-peat Lakers have done since Shaq and the Kobe Lakers did it. And yes, sometimes like immature kids, we argued, we fought, we bantered or insulted each other with offhand remarks, our feud. But make no mistake, even when the folks thought we were on bad terms, when the cameras were turned off, he and I would throw a wink at each other and say, let's go whoop some ass.
Shaq in Los Angeles remembering Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna today, 2/24/20. Coming up, the very strange race for the congressional seat Katie Hill held in the Antelope Valley.
What's weird about this is conceivably, you could have one person finish out Katie Hill's term in Congress now and another person who takes over next year.
Why a liberal talk show host and a former Trump aide who went to jail are vying for that same seat. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm leaving because of a misogynistic culture that gleefully consumed my naked pictures, capitalized on my sexuality, and enabled my abusive ex to continue that abuse, this time with the entire country watching.
Former Congresswoman Katie Hill's farewell speech last October. The Santa Clarita Democrats surprised political watchers by flipping the longtime Republican district in 2018. And then, less than a year later, she was out after an ugly marital dispute ensnared members of both her campaign and congressional staffs. Now, more than a dozen candidates are vying for her seat, including the Republican that Hill defeated in 2018. Also among the candidates, the progressive co-founder of the Young Turks, and even George Papadopoulos, the low-level Trump campaign figure who served time in prison after pleading guilty in the Mueller probe. Well, Jonathan Bastian joins me now to untangle all of this. He's host and reporter for KCRW and the morning anchor of KCRW Santa Barbara. Hi.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Good to have you. Okay. So how are the people in that area feeling about Katie Hill now?
It's been pretty confusing and exhausting for a lot of people on the ground. I've spoken to folks that have worked on her campaign for months, kind of building her up out of nowhere. You're hearing a lot of people saying they feel betrayed. They didn't expect this kind of behavior from her when she went to Washington. On the other hand, we have volunteers for her saying, hey, there's a double standard. If this was a man in Washington, he may not have resigned. She should not have succumbed to the pressure around her, and they would like her to still be in the seat. Either way, I think the whole thing is pretty deflating for a lot of Democrats, especially kind of the younger vote that tried to get her out. So what we're seeing, once again, is just a whole diverse array of feelings from folks in the Santa Clarita region.
Okay. Speaking of diverse, paint a picture of all the candidates who are now vying for that seat.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. Everybody wants to represent the Antelope Valley these days. It's a seat that we didn't really talk about a lot for years, to be honest. And Suddenly, as you mentioned, we have George Papadopoulos, who, as you mentioned, served 14 days in prison because of his connection to the Russians, and he worked for Trump. We have Cenk Uygur, who he's been supported by Bernie Sanders, founder of the Young Turks Network. And then we have some kind of more mainstream candidates. I'll talk more about her later, but Christy Smith, or that's where the Democrats are coalescing around. We have a former Navy jet pilot. So nearly a dozen candidates trying to take this seat, and it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in just a couple weeks.
And what are some of the issues and ideas that voters are looking for in these candidates?
You know, in many ways, it's what we're seeing all over California. It's cost of housing, it's homelessness, it's taxes, it's questions about schools. You know, I think Katie Hill ran a really successful race because she kept it super local. And what's happening now is we have a lot of folks that are coming in from not even inside the district, but may live an hour or two away trying to suddenly represent Santa Clarita. So I spoke about this with political science professor Lena Smythe from College of the Canyons, and here's what she told me.
We don't live in Los Angeles. We are kind of isolated from Los Angeles. So there really is this hometown feeling. And I think having candidates that are from the area is important to people.
Okay. So are there local candidates in the race that people like?
Right. So forget Papadopoulos. Forget Cenk Uygur. I don't think they're going to be real players in this race. But what we are seeing are two very strong Republicans. We have this former Navy pilot, Mike Garcia. He's a first-generation American, flew some 30 combat missions, and has since then has worked as an executive at Raytheon. He's been endorsed by a lot of folks and parties, the Ventura County Party, Los Angeles County Republican parties. You know, we also have the former Congressman Steve Knight, who was held in fairly high regard in the district. He lost by 7%, but is going right now neck to neck with Mike Garcia. So we'll look for those two on the Republican side. And then we have Christy Smith. She's emerging as the top Democrat in the field, picked up endorsements by Senator Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi, Gavin Newsom, and kind of represents the middle to more left side of the Democrats. And she's right now the top contender for the Democrats.
How does President Trump factor into this?
I mean, I think pretty heavily what we're seeing are that both Republican candidates are trying to align themselves as closely as possible with the president, saying they would have voted for all of his policies. Here again is Professor Lena Smythe.
President Trump was in Los Angeles and both candidates were there and both candidates posted pictures of themselves with President Trump on social media. So I definitely think that President Trump has an impact in this Republican primary.
Now, I also spoke to another professor who thinks that this may not actually play very well among the larger base in the district. Remember that Hillary Clinton carried the district in 2016. Here's Phil Gusson. He's also from the College of the Canyons. And here's what he told me.
The demographics of the 25th congressional district are changing. And so the Latino population is growing. One of the things that I've seen, and I have a skewed view because I'm a college professor, and so I interact more with young people, but the level of involvement among young people has also increased as well. And younger people tend to vote Democratic. So there does seem to be a shift to sort of a Democratic lean to the district that wasn't there before.
And if this holds true, I think it's going to look pretty good for the Democratic candidate coming out of this if we're seeing, as the professor said there, this change in demographics.
Right. But this election is pretty confusing because it's actually two elections. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so this is going to be a bit of a doozy for those that are voting in the 25th district. We essentially have two elections going on at the same time. So on March 3rd, people are going to go and they're going to vote. The first thing is going to be on who's going to fill Katie Hill's seat between now and January, because she still has pretty much a year left of her term. So if no candidate clears 50%, there's going to be a May 12th runoff between the two top vote getters. Okay, so that's number one. Now, also on March 3rd, there's just a general primary election for who's going to get the next full term starting in 2021, because Hill's seat was going to be up for re-election anyway. So in this case, the runoff would be during the general election in November. And Madeline, what's weird about this is conceivably, you could have one person finish out Katie Hill's term in Congress now and another person who takes over next year. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, my gosh. Well, will that be clear on the ballot? Will voters understand what they're being asked to do?
That's the big question. I've spoken with voters, and some think they only have to vote once. Well, they're going to have to vote two times on the same ballot. They're trying to get messaging out throughout the 25th district that, again, you're going to have to vote two times and just be aware of what you're doing. But I think there is fear, especially among those professors I spoke to, that there's going to be a lot of confusion when folks vote on March 3rd.
All right. KCRW's Jonathan Bastian. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, a new documentary about Miles Davis, a conversation with the director, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Miles Davis. He changed as much as his sound. Kind of Blue, Sketches of Spain, Bitches Brew. But even as he struggled with relationships, addiction, and his health, Miles Davis's music was a soundtrack for the Black experience in America. Director Stanley Nelson's new documentary, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, uses never-before-seen footage, some studio outtakes, and rare photos of Miles to tell his life story. The movie airs tomorrow night on PBS, and we're joined now by Stanley Nelson. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, you've made lots of documentaries. You've made documentaries about the Black Panthers, about Black colleges in America, Jonestown, Marcus Garvey, etc. What got you interested in making a movie about Miles?
Well, I'm a real music lover, a real jazz lover, and, you know, who's better than Miles Davis to make a movie about? You know, not only is he a great musician who changed the course of jazz and also the course of music several times in his lifetime, but also he's such an interesting individual. You know, it's he's a very complicated man. And so I think a complicated man makes or a complicated individual makes a more complicated film.
How did he become such a virtuoso trumpet player?
You know, Miles is an interesting guy. You know, he's given a trumpet when he's in grade school, and he's immediately just takes to it. You know, he's a genius, you know, at a young age. You know, but also, you know, Miles had two jobs in his life. He had a paper route for, you know, a couple of weeks as a kid, and he was a musician. So Miles, you know, because his family had some wealth, Miles was able to just play and practice and play. He then gets a job with a local group in St. Louis, in East St. Louis. And, you know, he's 14, and this is a group of men. And you know, we have pictures of him on the bandstand where, you know, he looks like a little kid. But what happens is because the other musicians have day jobs, you know, they all have to have day jobs, Miles becomes kind of the band leader, you know, in some ways, and you know, does the bookings and the books and becomes really great at leading these small groups. And, you know, some people say, you know, he might have been the greatest small group manager, you know, ever.
And that's where he met Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker.
Yeah, he's playing in East St. Louis, and Dizzy and Charlie come through with a group, and they need a trumpet player, a second trumpet player to sit in. And so Miles gets to sit in. He's still in high school. And he just, you know, realizes that that's his future. And, you know, when he gets out of high school, he gets on a train to New York. But, you know, his parents didn't want him to do that, especially his mother. So he enrolls in Juilliard. So he goes to New York for two things. One, to be a student at Juilliard, but also to find and play with Charlie Parker.
You have an actor reading parts of his autobiography throughout the movie, and I just want to play a clip of that when he's talking about that summer when he played with Dizzy and Bird.
The greatest feeling I ever had in my life with my clothes on was when I first met Dizzy and Bird. I was 18 years old. I decided right then and there I had to be in New York on 52nd Street where the action was.
Okay, we should address the issue of his voice. That, as again, that's an actor playing Miles Davis, but he had a famously raspy voice. How did he get that raspy voice?
Okay, so Miles, I think it was around 1956, he had throat polyps, and he had an operation to remove these polyps. It, you know, a pretty simple operation. But he was told, you know, that he could not speak or raise his voice for 2 weeks. And Miles gets mad at somebody and starts cursing him out and screaming at him. And that was it, you know, for the rest of his life. His voice was like that, you know, and it became Miles's signature.
It definitely feeds into the whole mystique of Miles Davis, which is quite a mystique. It's not just the music, although the music is just something else. It's also his look and his cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, Miles is just a fantastic character. As one person said to us, you know, they had never seen a man who was as beautiful as Miles when he was young. And, you know, Miles was very, very dark skinned, which was not the ideal at that point, you know, for among black folks. But Miles was undeniably beautiful, undeniably cool. You know, he's getting his clothes made, you know, tailor made, you know, from the middle 50s on. He's driving, you know, Ferraris and Lamborghinis. He's named one of the best dressed men in America in, I think it's 1958. You know, he's hanging out constantly with beautiful women, you know, and he has that voice, you know, and he's just cool. And his music also has this kind of coolness to it for much of, you know, the 50s and the 60s, where Miles, you know, decides, you know, he makes this decision that he's not going to, you know, play the trumpet, you know, in those high, you know, quick notes that you hear, you know, so often with Dizzy Gillespie or Louis Armstrong, that he's going to kind of slow it down, and that the pauses are just as important as the notes that he plays.
Well, let's hear an example of that. Here's a song. Here's a bit of the song, "It Never Entered My Mind." Well, that's just beautiful. And it really is romantic.
Yeah, I mean, the sequence where we use "It Never Entered My Mind," where we talk about Miles's ballads, is probably, you know, at least at this point, you know, my favorite scene that I've ever worked on and edited. You know, it's just, and to me, an incredible scene where we tried to talk about the music and talk about the beauty of Miles's music. And, you know, we have great people, you know, Herbie Hancock and others, and Carlos Santana and others describe, you know, Miles's ballads and the beauty of Miles's ballads. And it's just, I think, a really wonderful sequence in the film.
How much of his music was preconceived and composed before he got members of his band together versus improvised?
You know, I think one of the things we talk about in the film is, as Miles' music progresses, it becomes more and more improvised. You know, he goes to France in 56 and records a soundtrack for a film called Elevator to the Gallows. And the way they do it is they just put the film up on the screen in front of him and his band, and they play along to the film and record, you know, this incredible album that's totally improvised. You know, and I think he learned something from that. And, you know, a couple of years later, he comes back and records, you know, one of his most famous albums, Kind of Blue.
There was a dark side to Miles Davis. He was married several times and with a lot of women, many of whom say he was physically violent with them. And Frances Taylor, in particular, one of his wives, says that she was a dancer and she was cast in West Side Story. And he told her she couldn't be in it, and she dropped out. I wonder if you could talk about that, his relationship with women and why he was so violent with them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never know. I mean, it's hard to say definitively why somebody's like that. But one of the things I found that most telling, you know, Miles actually, from his autobiography, you know, in the film, he tells a story about how his father, he saw his mother and father have physical fights. And, you know, he says, you know, it had to affect us somehow, but I don't know how. And I think as the film goes on, you kind of see how it affected Miles, because he has very abusive relationships with women, with Frances and other women. But one of the things that's clear in the film is he really needed the women. You know, it's clear how much he needed Frances, you know, and he's heartbroken when Frances finally leaves. as someone says in the film, you know, Francis was with him for 9 years, and those years are, you know, Elevated to the Gallows, you know, Kind of Blue, the beginning of the Second Quintet, you know, Someday My Prince Will Come, you know, all that stuff comes, you know, when he's in a stable relationship with Francis.
And then he plugs in. He's influenced by the Woodstock generation. And again, a woman that he's with, Betty Mabry, right? She introduces him to that kind of music?
Yeah, Betty Mabry, who becomes Betty Davis, who's also a musician, introduces him, you know, to rock music. And Miles starts, you know, listening more and more to Jimi Hendrix and Sly and the Family Stone and James Brown, and wants to, you know, kind of change the way he's going. And so he comes out, with Bitches Brew, you know, one of the most important albums in jazz.
Okay, that's definitely a different sound.
Yeah.
Kind of Blue. Do you think that survives the test of time the way Kind of Blue does?
Yeah, in a very different way. Uh-huh. I think it does. I mean, you know, one of the things that was really interesting for us in making the film was that there's a whole generation that ties in to the Electric Miles in a way that other people tie into, you know, Kind of Blue and those albums. You know, Greg Tate talks in the film about how that was, you know, his Miles, and that's who they knew. And, you know, whether you like it or not, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, I could say, I mean, I don't go home after a hard day and put on the Corner, you know. It's those albums are very challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you think about, you know, Return to Forever, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Weather Report, all these groups came out of the musicians who were playing with Miles on Bitches Brew.
Hmm. So he died fairly young, 65, in 1991, from a stroke, complications from a stroke?
Yeah, Miles, you know, died early. One of the interesting things, I know his father died at almost the same age, and I believe his grandfather also, you know, died at almost the same age.
Hmm. So not necessarily because of all the drugs that he had done in his life.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, you know, Miles had so many, you know, that illnesses that he just, you know, had throughout his life. He had sickle cell, you know, he had broken his hip a couple of times. I mean, there were a lot of things that Miles had that you know, just compiled on top of the drug use that was off and on for so much of his life.
Mm-hmm. And when you came away from this, how did you feel about him as a person, not just as a musician, but as a person?
You know, I mean, Miles was a very, very challenging person. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, he's kind of an enigma. You know, one of the last lines in the film is from Frances, and you know, she says, you know, how could a man who played such beautiful music, you know, be so rough? And then she says, you know, I don't regret, you know, but I still love. You know, all the musicians that played with Miles loved him, you know, and love him to this day, you know. There's the good and bad of Miles, and that's just the reality of who Miles was.
Well, Stanley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stanley Nelson is the director of Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, and you can see his documentary tomorrow night on PBS. Kind of fitting that we are hearing this music on the day of Kobe Bryant's memorial, Michelle.
Exactly. We've got a couple more clips from the really moving memorial service today at the Staples Center. Michael Jordan, the Chicago Bulls great, eulogized Kobe Bryant. I'm going to play a little clip of tape from that.
Maybe it surprised people that Kobe and I were very close friends. But we were very close friends. Kobe was my dear friend. He was like a little brother. Everyone always wanted to talk about the comparisons between he and I. I just wanted to talk about Kobe.
And you can hear the emotion in his voice. Mm-hmm. He's just speaking through a stream of tears. But it was also a little lighthearted. Kobe's former teammate Shaquille O'Neal got up there too, had a good one-liner there.
The day Kobe gave my respect was the guys were complaining. I said, Shaq, Kobe's not passing the ball. I said, I'll talk to him. I said, Kobe, there's no I in team. And Kobe said, I know, but there's an in me and that mother.
So, yeah, just kind of all over. It was really beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Michelle Aloy. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.